Hello and welcome to our micronutrients presentation on vitamin B9, which is mostly known as folate, but officially it's vitamin B9. Very few people call it that. And I'm really excited to be here to share this information. This is a nutrient that has a lot of function and a lot of really popularity in today's press, because of the gene, the biggest gene that is associated with the MTHFR gene. But you'll also see that there's a whole bunch of other genes that are related to folate and a whole bunch of other functions that are critical without folate. So let's go ahead and get started. Before I begin, I want to make sure that you're aware that this presentation is not intended to replace a one-on-one relationship with a qualified healthcare professional, and it's not medical advice. It's me sharing with you from my knowledge and information and research and clinical experience. And when I share this stuff with you and you share it with your clients, it's really important that you understand that even though you may ask questions and it might give you answers, and this might relate to your own health decisions and your own health practices, you've got to make sure that you're taking it as education. So if you do have diagnosed conditions and you are working with a medical practitioner, or the clients that you are coaching with, counseling with, are having situations like that, that you recommend that they go see their practitioner in order to make sure that whatever changes, dietary or otherwise, they do are in conjunction with whatever is really going on deep in their health. So I want to show you just again, I like to show you the chart, the B vitamins at a glance. I've got 12 of them listed here. We will do presentations on most of these. Some of them are not really considered fully vitamins, but they have numbers. And so just so that we have a full set from 1 to 12, I've listed them all. We do have presentations on B1, B2, B3, B5, B6, B7, which is biotin, B9, which is folate, and B12, which is cobalamin. And the ones in between are kind of loosely categorized, and B10 is sometimes called. It's a particular form of folate, which we'll be looking at today, all the different forms. And sometimes it's considered B10, but mostly we just put everything in folate together with folate. So this is kind of your map of the B vitamins. On the site, on the B complex page, you're going to have a list of these, and you're going to have some cheat sheets with the shortcuts of what they do. So in a nutshell, vitamin B9 or folate is responsible for red blood cell production, DNA repair, and brain function. And we could leave it at that, right? If we were taking a basic ABC nutrition class, here's your vitamins and here's what they do, this would be enough. But really, I want you to understand how folate works in the body, what all the mechanisms that occur are, what are the different forms of folate, and I want you to look at some of these pathways. I do not expect you to memorize any of these pathways. I expect you to be able to pull them out and look them up when you're dealing with a client who you're going, I keep giving them folate, but they're not responding, or they show signs of folate deficiency. Where could the breakdown be? That you're going to be able to pull these charts out and look at them. So this overview is to give you a lay of the land, a map of what you have available at your disposal when working with people, and tools and resources and references that you can go if you really do want to go deeper. The big thing in the news today is MTHFR. You keep hearing that. That's related to folate metabolism. And there's a big kind of no-no, I believe, in the movement of, somebody has this MTHFR, test to see if they have this MTHFR SNP, and then give them folate. And there's a whole lot more to it, and we'll go way more into that in our nutrigenomics methylation class. But for now, we're going to look at some of those pathways, and I'm going to show you that it's just part of a big picture, that it is important, and then there are other considerations. So sit tight, get a good piece of paper, and take some notes, because we're going to go on a whirlwind ride, maybe more than you ever wanted to know about folate. So let's talk about some general folate information. It is a water-soluble B vitamin. All the B vitamins are. It's naturally present in many foods, a lot of foods. Unlike things like B12 and some of the others where you have to just eat a lot, B folate is actually really easy to get enough of it in food. The issue is always, are you absorbing it well? Do you have things that interfere with it? And is it the right form for you and your specific biochemistry and genetics, or for your client as in this case? It's also known as pteroglutamate or pteromonoglutamate, and we'll look at what that means when we look at its structure. There's a form of folate called folic acid that's used in dietary supplements and fortified foods. It's actually the monoglutamate form, which will make sense to you in a little bit. And it's actually a form that, as we'll see as this presentation unfolds, can be detrimental in many people, especially if they have particular genetic inclinations. So folate is needed to make DNA and other genetic material, which means to me, is it important? You betcha. If you can't make DNA, you can't synthesize proteins, which means that structurally, chemically, neurochemically, hormonally, enzymatically, immunologically, the body is not going to work well if you can't make DNA. So folate is critical. Folate is also needed for the body's cells to divide. So that mitosis process of dividing and reproducing itself is an important folate function. And what a lot of people don't realize is folate actually comes from the Latin word folium. And guess what that means? Leaf. And guess what some of our best sources of folate are is leaves, especially uncooked leaves, green leafy vegetables. So this is what it looks like. Don't need to memorize it. Do you need to recognize it? Well, if you're out there in the literature and you're looking up specific articles for specific conditions, or you're just doing some research and you see pictures of it, it'd be nice if you looked at it, oh, there's folate. Is that going to happen in the short term? If you happen to be a biochemical geek and you study a lot of biochemistry, sure. But like other B vitamins, and B12 is one of them that has an even more complicated structure than this. It's got separate pieces that are put together, and it's variations in some of these different pieces that make for the different forms of folate, which actually can have very different effects on the body. So it's got what's called the tyridine ring over on the left-hand side of your picture, where there's an ammonia group and a couple of rings, a hydroxyl group up at the top. That's the black part of this diagram. In the middle, you've got para-aminobenzoic acid. You may have heard of that before, PABA. It used to be a very active ingredient in sunscreen, might still be. And then you've got on the far end, the red part, the orangey red part, is glutamic acid. Okay, which on its own is actually an excitatory neurotransmitter. So you've got these three pieces, and on the glutamic acid, it may be one of those glutamic acid, what they call residues, or in the metabolically active forms, the ones that we're going to look at as the ones that enter into these chemical pathways that we want them to enter into, they're actually what's called the polyglutamic forms, so to speak. They have multiple glutamic acid residues. So they may have up to nine, actually. It's been seen. So any number is, that's where the variation happens in a lot of the different forms. So that's what it looks like. Here's a couple of the different ones compared. So at the top are more of the folates, the metabolically active pieces. They are in the reduced form. The reduced form, which means that they are more unstable, right? Because reduced forms of things can become oxidized. Oxidized forms are more stable, but they're also not as good for the body because they're oxidized. They're rusted, so to speak. So the reduced form is the form found in the foods. And like I said, there's going to be multiple of the glutamic acid residues, but I put a little arrow into the different spots where the folate looks different from the synthetic form folic acid, which is a monoglutamic form, and it's an oxidized form. It's usually found in fortified foods and vitamin supplements. Very little, if any, is found in nature. So you can see the difference up here, right around here. You see the plus, that means it's more volatile. That's the reduced piece, and something can come in and snag an electron from it and cause it to become oxidized. Then you've got in here, it's just the shape, right here, the NH that's connecting the two pieces. It's a different shape. And then up here, we've got a COO minus, so that's not complete. There's some room for metabolic activity up here, whereas here you have two oxygens to complete that bond. And then down here, the same thing. So this is the folic acid part. This is the folate. And you may be thinking, well, why would the unstable one be the more metabolically active or the one that's better for us? And it's just because of that, because folate's job is to be a donor and an acceptor of carbons. So we'll go through that a little bit more detail. So that's basically what it looks like. So when you see folic acid versus folate or MTH or 5-MTH on a bottle or when you're reading an article, you'll kind of got an idea of what the difference is. So let's look a little bit about folate chemistry. The supplements are the pteromonoglutamate, the most stable and oxidized form. The food forms, the reduced, generally have up to 9 glutamate residues. The most common ones that we see are 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, and tetrahydrofolate is usually abbreviated THF, and 5-methyltetrahydrofolate is 5-MTHF. So that's your tetrahydrofolate, tetra meaning 4, hydrofolate. So it's got 4 of these hydroxy water kind of parts to it. And then the methyl tetrahydrofolate. So when you see 5-MTHF, you'll see that on supplements because some of the natural supplements will have that. I know Thorne has one. It's called MTHF. You might see it listed as 5-MTHF. You might see it listed as L5, and we'll look at some of those differences. But there's a variety of different ones. But it's methyl tetrahydrofolate is the more desirable one to take in most cases and not all cases. And then another form is the 10-formyl THF, which you see more naturally occurring in food. We'll show you some charts. We'll show you all the different forms and how all the interconversions happen, just so you get an idea, not expected that you know this walk away like as a folic acid chemistry major. Okay, the reduced dihydro and tetrahydro forms are unstable. They've identified up to 150 different forms. And the bioavailability from food getting into the body and being able to be utilized ranges. It's usually estimated to be about 50%, but it can be as high as 96% in of all things cooked lima beans to 25% in romaine lettuce. It's estimated that 50 to 95% can be lost in food preparation and processing, mainly because it's very heat sensitive. So if you lightly steam some leafy greens, you will lose some of the folate, not a tremendous amount, but the more you cook it, the more you lose. So up to 95% can be lost when you take a food and then you process it. So a can of spinach that's been highly processed, cooked, and then put into a can and vacuum sealed probably has very little folate, active folate left in it. Whereas if you pick up some fresh spinach and you chop it up and you put some olive oil and vinegar or olive oil and lemon and some salt on it and have it for dinner, you're going to get a tremendous amount of folate. So the sensitivity also depends on the form of the folate that's in there. I don't think it's important for us to get into all the different forms and how sensitive they are. That's like getting a little bit too deep. So we'll take a broad picture. We'll go deep. We'll come back out at the broad picture. We'll go deep again. And know that the broad picture helps you. The go deep helps you to know that there's an issue here, that if you are dealing with someone where you got to get to the heart of a problem and you're suspicious, you at least have a starting point for going deeper and resourcing. We have a lot of references both throughout the presentation and then at the back. Folate acts as a coenzyme in many different reactions in the body.
The coenzyme form of it is the tetrahydrofolic acid, the THF, and it's important for normal red blood cell synthesis and the synthesis of lots of other cells, so cell synthesis, cell creation. It's also involved in DNA synthesis and cell division, and as such, there's a particular chemotherapeutic agent that targets this process, and it's called methotrexate. It's also involved in amino acid metabolism and also mitosis or cell division. So there's several active forms of tetrahydrofolate that are active as coenzymes, and they accept and donate one carbon unit. So they're passing these one carbon units around, and that's their job. So it's 5 and 10 formal THF, tetrahydrofolate, 5 formamino THF, 5-10 methanol THF, 5-10 methylene THF, and 5-methyl THF. So these are the coenzyme forms, and these are the ones that are active in these very important reactions where folate acts as a coenzyme. Again, it's for normal DNA synthesis and cell division and amino acid metabolism and normal red blood cell synthesis.
Let's look at folate absorption. Like, how is it absorbed where? It's definitely an easier absorption pathway than poor old vitamin B12. It got the difficult one of all the B vitamins. It needs to be hydrolyzed down to monoglutamic acid form by something called the conjugase enzymes. These conjugase enzymes are in the brush border of the jejunum, the lower or the middle part of the small intestine where all the absorption happens, and it's zinc dependent. So in order for us to absorb the folate, we need to have zinc. Also, this hydrolysis happens in pancreatic juice and in bile, and this is by the conjugase enzymes. Active transport is the way that the folate gets pulled across the membranes and then eventually into the bloodstream. So active transport, meaning that there's a protein that it depends upon to pull it in. It's not like the folate's there and it just like leaks across. That would be passive diffusion. Now, some passive diffusions occurs when there's a huge dose taken, what's called a pharmacological dose, because it actually pushes its way in because of the gradient. There's much more on the inside of the intestinal lumen than inside the cells. But for the most part, the active transport is the way it goes. It's a sodium-dependent pump, which is common for these active transport pumps, meaning it has to have sodium to kind of latch on and pull it across the membrane. It's pH dependent, and it's found in the jejunal brush border. Some forms of folate, for example, the one in milk, is actually absorbed more in the ileum than it is in the jejunum, but that's rare. Most of it is absorbed in the jejunum. Okay, the average absorption from food is estimated to be about 50%. So if you're feeling like somebody actually needs 1,000 micrograms of folate, you've got to make sure that they take 2,000 in their food, which quite frankly isn't all that hard if you get somebody on a really good plant-strong, vegetable-strong diet. There's a slightly higher absorption of the monoglutamate forms in the supplements, but there's lots of metabolic downsides to taking it that way. So things that influence the folate, well, increased absorption happens when there's an empty stomach, when you're drinking water with it, when it's in the presence of vitamin B12, or vitamin C. Those things increase folate absorption. Now, the good news is that much of the food that contains folate also contains an abundant amount of vitamin C. And if you're eating uncooked leafy greens, there's a lot of water with it. What decreases absorption? Well, zinc deficiency, we looked at that because that brush border needs to have zinc in order to pull that folate in. Alcohol can disrupt it. Certain legumes, especially lentils, which is kind of ironic because lentils is one of the top sources of folate, yet there's an inhibitory effect. And we see that a fair amount in nature. Sometimes the foods that have super high amounts of things actually have inhibitors. We see that with spinach and oxalates. Oxalates inhibit the iron uptake in the spinach. Other things that decrease absorption are actually cabbage, oranges, and mutations in a gene called SLC46A1, and we'll see where that lies before it's a folate receptor. Inflammatory bowel disease, Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis, those kind, celiac disease, bacterial overgrowth, parasite overgrowth, decreased hydrochloric acid, pancreatitis, gastric surgery, antacids, and green or black tea. Now, all of these have a little or a lot of interference, so it's a matter of if you're suspecting somebody having a folate deficiency and you're thinking, wow, they get an awful lot of leafy greens, you want to check some of these other things to see if they're not absorbing it all because they've got some parasites or they're taking antacids or they have celiac disease that hasn't been treated, you know, treated meaning they haven't been off of gluten for very long, and various mutations. So let's just look and see how all this is transported and stored. In the liver, they're stored small but in insignificant quantities. It's not huge, but there is some storage. It's not like vitamin B12, where we have 7 years worth. In folate, we might have, I would say, less than 7 days worth for sure. In portal circulation, it's going to be stored as 5-MTHF. So when it's in the liver, the circulation within the liver, 5-MTHF. Within the liver itself, we're looking at 33% of it is THF, tetrahydrofolate, 37% is 5-MTHF, 23% is 10-formyl, and 5% is 5-formyl. So let's look at the blood. Well, the red blood cells actually contain more folate than the plasma. So if you're wanting to test to see if someone has enough folate, just taking it in the blood will reflect their more recent store. So if they took a bunch of folate the day before and then they went and took the blood test the next day, they may see that folate in the blood, but it's not a long-term store. The RBCs, the red blood cells, actually store that for a longer period of time, up to 2 to 3 months. So you can actually tell better a person's folate status if you do a red blood cell folate level. Once it's in the blood, the glutamate residues have been removed, and 2/3 of it is protein bound. Most of that is bound to folate-specific receptors, but some of it is bound to more general receptors, for example, albumin, and that accounts for about 50% of the bound folate. So 50% of it is, 2/3 of it is protein bound, and of that 2/3, 50% of that, which would be 1/3 of the total folate, is bound to albumin. The rest of it is to specific receptors, and we'll be looking at what some of those specific receptors are. The forms that are circulating in the blood are THF, 5-MTHFF, and 10-formyl, a little bit of others, but those are the main ones. And then the urine will show any excess over and above what that person needs will be excreted in the urine. It needs to be replenished on a daily basis. Like I said, you have a small storage in the liver, so you can go maybe a few days without folate, but you certainly want to do on a regular basis. You want to see people having it on a regular basis. Now, if someone is doing a fast or a cleanse, those short stores, you can run low in folate. So sometimes taking some B vitamins during a cleanse can be helpful in this case if they're starting out folate deficient. So let's look at folate transporters and receptors. There are receptors for folate found in the liver, and in the renal tubules, and that's theorized to be for retaining what's needed so that the folate doesn't all get excreted, that we can pull some of it back and keep it circulating. And then the hematopoietic cells, what are those? Those are the cells that make red blood cells. They make blood cells. So what are the types of receptors? There's several, but these are the four most common ones that are written about. The PCFT, which is the proton-coupled folate transporter, and that's related to a gene, the SLC46A1 gene. So if someone has issues with that gene, they're not going to be able to bind the folate as effectively as if they don't. RFC is reduced folate carrier, and that's related to the DHFR gene. The folate receptor alpha and beta. Alpha is related to the FOLR1 gene, and the folate beta is related to the FOLR2 gene. So let's look at folate transporters and receptors in a little bit more detail. Like I said, PCFT is proton coupled folate transporter related to the SLC46A1 gene, and it has a major role in intestinal transport. Mutations cause hereditary folate malabsorption. So if there's mutations in that gene, they're going to not be able to absorb their folate real well, and it's going to be really important that supplemental folate be given. Defects lead to impaired folate transport to the brain. Okay, so it's really important that if there's a defect in this gene, that we're given a lot more folate to try to overcome the deficiency. So a reduced folate carrier related to the DHFR gene helps with transporting it across the blood-brain barrier. BBB is blood-brain barrier. And that happens when the extracellular folate is high, when we have a high amount of it. It's cytotoxic, meaning toxic to the cells in severe folate deprivation. So whereas this is an awesome thing to have and we need it desperately when we have sufficient folate, if we have a folate deficiency, this reduced folate carrier can actually be toxic to the cells. So there's these double-edged swords here. So the folate receptor alpha, again related to the FOLR1 gene, it mediates uptake of folate by what's called endocytosis, meaning that the folate is engulfed into the cell. It's just surrounds it. Think of it as a Pac-Man cell gobbling up the folate. And it facilitates transport across the blood-brain barrier when extracellular folate is low. So in low concentrations, this receptor is going to be more active. The folate receptor beta, related to the FOLR2 gene, carries the folate into the cells, and it has an affinity for a neutral pH. So if it's an environment where the cells are either too acidic or too alkaline, that receptor isn't going to work real well. So that's why, you know, we look at a lot of things when we're working with our clients to try to help them to stay more alkaline, to keep their tissues more alkaline. And this is yet one of the issues that it helps with. We know that being more alkaline in your tissue versus acidic, and when I say alkaline, I mean more neutral, which is about where we want to be. That neutral to slightly alkaline pH is where it works the best. So folate absorption can be related to fetal development. The folate is essential for the proper development of the embryo and the fetus, which makes sense, right? Because it's related to DNA and to mitosis. The placenta concentrates folate to the fetal circulation, takes it from mom and concentrates it and gives it to baby. So baby ends up with a higher concentration of folate than mom. And all of the various receptor types have been associated with folate transport across the placenta during pregnancy. So again, if mom has an issue with any of the genetics, it's going to impact the baby. So let's look at folate storage in the body. The total storage is 11 to 28 milligrams. And if we look at the RDA for folate, the recommended amount during pregnancy being 400 to 800. So it's 400 micrograms is what most people need, but 800 during pregnancy. 800 micrograms is a little less than 1 milligram, which would mean that, you know, the storage in the body could be anywhere from, you know, maybe 15 days to a little over a month. Okay, so it's not a lot compared to vitamin B12, which case the liver can store up to 7 years worth. The liver stores half of that. So the liver will store anywhere from like 5.5 to 14 milligrams. Intracellular binding proteins are really important for folate storage. So the proteins that bind the folate inside the cells need to be intact. Folate acts as a coenzyme and a one-carbon transporter in both the cytosol, the goop inside the cells, and in the mitochondria. And the main storage forms are the polyglutamate forms, the THF and the 5-MTHF. So we've got these stores, but we, you know, so we're doing a short-term faster cleanse, you're not going to run out. But it's really important that you have people maintaining it on a daily basis. And a lot of people in the U.S. don't eat enough of the folate-rich foods. This picture is actually taken from our textbook, which I highly recommend if you don't have it, you get. It's Advanced Nutrition and Human Metabolism. I have the fourth edition, which is not the latest edition, but it's fine. And I would recommend that you get whatever edition you want to, but the latest editions are in the several hundred dollar range, whereas the earlier editions are in the, I would say $25 to $30 range. So no worries, get the fourth edition. That's what I have. And this is on page 302. And I just wanted to show it to you. And I would highly recommend that you go to the book or you print these off to look at it. But I wanted to show you that there's so much here and there's so many different forms of folate. So if you look at the top, you take folate, it's interconvertible both directions to dihydrofolate, and it requires energy to do it. So it goes that this is a niacin dependent, NADPH gets converted down to NADP by a reductase enzyme and converts that. That then goes down to the tetrahydrofolate, THF form, and that's another reductase here. And then that tetrahydrofolate form goes to the 5 tetrahydrofolate, and there's a response where we're adding the glutamate and there's an enzymatic reaction here, and then it goes down to the 5-10 methylene tetrahydrofolate. And at any point here, there's not all of it is going to go down to the next step because we're going to need some of this in the different forms. But you can see the tetrahydrofolate can also be converted down to the 5-methylene tetrahydrofolate. And there's a couple of amino acids that are important, serine and glycine. And then to go from the 5-methylene to the 5-methyl, which is going to go into that methylation pathway, we'll show you in a bit, there's some other nutrients and it's another riboflavin and niacin are required there. So I'm only showing you this not to have you memorize it or to get overly like paranoid about it or concerned about it or worried about it, but I'm just to show you that there's so much involved with the mechanisms for converting folate into its various forms and a bunch of different nutrients, niacin, riboflavin, glycine, serine, water, of course, and some of those reductase enzymes. Okay, so this is in the book. You can read about it, but it's just to show you that it's a complicated process. There's a lot of back and forth and interconversions. And when we look later at some gene pathways, there's a lot of different genes involved at these different places that can be impaired based on what a person comes into this world with. So we've talked a little bit about methylation. I want to talk to you about methylation because folate is super important in methylation. It's one of the major methyl donors in the body. And methyl donors are molecules that can donate a methyl group. And a methyl group is a carbon and 3 hydrogens, so CH3. So some of our famous methyl donors are SAMe, S-adenosylmethionine E, folate, vitamin B12, trimethylglycine, that's TMG, and dimethylglycine, and that's DMG. So you can see the DM, that's methyl, dimethyl, dimethyl. The folate and the B12 don't have them in their names, but the active form of folate does. It's 5-methyl tetrahydrofolic acid. And then we have, when we buy B12 supplements, you know, you can get various forms, and methyl B12 is preferred over, say, cyanocobalamin. Or cyano-B12. So that's what methylation is. It's a really simple process. It's just a matter of passing it. It's like this is a hot potato. This methyl group is a hot potato. And folate says, here, you take it. Oh, here, you take it. And then passes it around. And SAMe is actually the main methyl donor, which takes this and hands it off to be used in DNA synthesis. So some of the functions of methylation is to turn on and off genes, to process chemicals, to detox, it's part of the detox pathways, endogenous and exogenous, so things coming from the outside and produced from the inside. It's important for building neurotransmitters like norepinephrine, epinephrine, serotonin, and melatonin. It's important for metabolizing neurotransmitters, so dopamine and epinephrine, meaning breaking them down so that the pieces can be reused or excreted. Processing hormones like estrogen, And methylated estrogens are far more protective than hydroxylated estrogens. And when we study estrogen in detail, we'll see those pathways. But the methylation functions are normal, are good, are robust, then we can keep estrogen safe. It's important for building some immune cells like T cells and natural killer cells. It's important for synthesizing DNA bases, which is one of the biggest things and the biggest problems that happens when we're low in folate or vitamin B12 or both. It helps to produce energy. CoQ10, carnitine, creatinine, and ATP are involved there. It helps protect coatings on the nerves and maintains and builds cell membranes via phosphatidylcholine. So these are all the things that methylation can do. And we're leading into, okay, folate is this vitamin that's super important. Folate's critical for methylation. These are some of the important things that will happen as a result. So just saying, well, folate, it's, you know, responsible for red blood cells is a small piece of it. DNA repair, it's widespread and ubiquitous, the need for it throughout the body. So let's take a look at the methylation pathway. And here we're looking at how methylation works. You know, we have these forms of folate. It goes down and through this pathway. It's shown as a cycle. Obviously, in your body, we don't have these little cycles, but when things go around and around and around and they cycle back, we show them as a cycle. So you can see where the folate goes in here, right? You can see where there's the conversion to the methyl folate over here. Anyway, these are the various pathways. So basically, the folate comes through and it runs around and it gets methylated. And then it takes the methyl group and it gives it to B12. The B12 then takes the methyl group and it takes homocysteine and it lops on that methyl group onto homocysteine and it turns it into methionine. So we'll talk about homocysteine in a bit and how it's implicated with so many different health challenges, and especially cardiovascular risk, that when we don't have enough methyl groups, when we don't have enough folate to donate its methyl group to the B12, which then takes the homocysteine and converts it to methionine, we have problems because we get a buildup of homocysteine, which causes a problem. The methionine then gets converted to SAMe, and then that's the main methyl donor in the body. This is a pathway planner that Dr. Ben Lynch has. You can go to his site and you can download this or you can download pieces of it. It's an awesome chart and it gives you the complexity of all of this. The folate pathways over here. This is the pathway where we have the B12 and the homocysteine going up to methionine and SAMe. But then you can see there's so much more. So homocysteine can be elevated even when there's plenty of folate and B12 and the methylation is working fine. If there's a deficiency of vitamin B6, which isn't going to allow the homocysteine to then enter the sulfation pathway where glutathione is synthesized. And over here is a lot of the neurotransmitter pathways. So you could see it's complicated. This is an emerging science. If it's something that fascinates you, by all means, go to Dr. Lynch's site, and he has some videos of his seminars, and he goes into a lot of detail. We will go through it in the depth that I think everybody needs, and I'm constantly updating our particular presentations on this as well. So the relationship between folate and vitamin B6 is here. So when you go down from folate to dihydrofolate and then tetrahydrofolate, you need serine converts to glycine, and that's where B6 is required. And we see this in our amino transferases in our blood tests, our ALT and AST. The serine to glycine needs B6. And when we have low amino transferases, then it could be because we're having a B6 deficiency. So a lack of B6 can slow down the conversion from the THF, the tetrahydrofolate, to the 5-10-methylene tetrahydrofolate, and then around and up to the side over where we go to the 5-methyl THF. I told you, I just keep showing you the pathways so you start to see them. Eventually, they will make sense. Again, the folate pathways over here on the left, you can see the B12 and the folate, and we donate and we come around. There's an enzyme called methionine synthase, and there are some SNPs that are related to all of these pathways. So here's the relationship between B12, folate, and DNA. Okay, so the B12 comes around, and the tetrahydrofolate goes into the DNA synthesis. So we have the folate, tetrahydrofolate, going down to 5-MTHF, going through that cycle, regenerating the THF, and then giving it out to DNA synthesis. What I really want to point out here is when you're in this folate pathway, the folate goes around to the 5-MTHF, it gets trapped. The methyl groups get trapped here if we don't have enough peptide. And then the synthesis of the DNA slows down. Vitamin B12, one last picture, similar. They're just all showing it in a slightly different way. Again, here's the folate pathway. We get the methyl tetrahydrofolate. We go through and donate it here. We get SAMe, which goes into the methylated DNA, RNA, and making protein. So that's the way this works. Whew. Take a deep breath. A lot there we covered. Folate, bottom line, is important for methylation, which is important for DNA synthesis and repair and red blood cell formation, and it's important in pregnancy and fetal development, and so many things that it's important to. And so it's really important to have good folate status, and it's really important to have good status of the other nutrients that work together with folate body. So let's talk about MTHFR. MTHFR is part of that pathway, and it's part of that final pathway of taking the folate in whatever form and converting it into the 5-methyl form. So MTHFR stands for methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. Remember I said there were reductase enzymes happening there? We didn't label them in there, but some of those pathways are related to MTHFR. So MTHFR, popular press, a lot of docs are just testing for MTHFR and telling people to take folate, but I'm here to say that it's a much more complicated picture, and I want you to understand it. So I'm going to be showing you some diagrams in a very short while, and we'll go through them. We won't go through them in grueling detail, but you will have those diagrams, and we will revisit them and revisit them and revisit them. So increased homocysteine, often abbreviated as HCY, is a problem when we have an MTHFR issue. We're going to see that in a minute. Increased risk of cardiovascular disease or thrombosis is an issue. When you have insufficient substrate for DNA repair, synthesis, or methylation, then there's a lot of things that don't happen, and that can be a cancer issue. It could be a lack of healing issue. With MTHFR issues, there's an increased risk of pregnancy miscarriage. So very common, people with MTHFR genetic SNPs have difficulty carrying a pregnancy to term, and it can be heartbreaking. And if you're working with someone like that, you owe it to them to make sure you test this and help them support them in ways that hopefully they can overcome it. Methotrexate is a drug that's used in treating RA, rheumatoid arthritis, and cancer. When you have an MTHFR issue, it affects the dosing on that. So it's important that the doctor that's prescribing that, I don't recommend that medication because it's horrible, but some people need it, that the doctor really know what the person's MTHFR status is. You can have neurotransmitter problems. Remember we looked at when we don't have proper methylation, it affects serotonin and dopamine. Excess folic acid in someone with an MTHFR, like synthetic folic acid in a supplement, can lead to problems like cancer because it blocks methylfolate, and it blocks it both at the cell state, but it also blocks the uptake of methylfolate into the brain. So that's why folic acid is not a good thing to do, and we'll look at that. And then really looking at this and know that there's three receptors, FOLR1, 2, and 3 folate receptors that can be blocked by dairy, especially in the brain. So if you're looking at people and they're having some brain issues and they get off of dairy and they feel better, this could be part of the mechanism that's at play. I'm a big fan of taking people off, anybody that has health issues, off of dairy and gluten and some other foods that I don't think are serving them well. So here's a list that I put together a while ago of genes associated with folate metabolism. And you might do a 23andMe or some other sort of test on someone to see what their genes are. And all of these are related to folate in one way or the other. The FOLR1, 2, and 3 are very specific to it because it binds MTHF and transport into the cell. So you cannot uptake the methylfolate into the cells if these are blocked. The support column lists some of the things that have been shown to help if somebody has these specific gene issues. Lipids and phospholipids in particular, like phosphatidylcholine and serine and inositol, can be helpful, as with the SLC19A1 folate receptor as well. There's another one called ALDH1L1, which affects one of the conversions from the formal form into the tetrahydrofolate form. So that one is supported by supplementation of tetrahydrofolate. The DHFR gene affects the tetrahydrofolate conversion to dihydrofolate. And so it's the other direction from what we usually go. You can support that with vitamin B3 or a niacin adenine dinucleotide. The MTHFS gene is related to ATP, or the formation using ATP of the 5-formyl THF tetrahydrofolate into 5-10 MTHF. So the thing is, these things all require energy. All these forms, anytime you see a reaction that says ATP plus something equals ADP plus something else, that means that required energy. To go from ATP to ADP requires energy. So a lot of times people are low in energy because they are deficient in folate, but a lot of times people are deficient in folate because they're low in energy due to mitochondrial dysfunction. So we have to be looking at all of it to help someone get through this. It's not a simple matter of, oh, they have this genetic problem with folate, and now let's just give them some folate. There's more to it than that. We got to look at mitochondrial function and hormone function as well. Another one is the MTHFD1, and there's 3 different reactions that it's responsible for. I won't go through each of these, and we're going through alphabet soup. You're not going to remember them anyway, but you have a chart. And giving tetrahydrofolate can be supportive there. There's a gene called SHMT. There's a 1 and a 2, and that has a process in that pathway I showed you earlier. That's one of the genes that controls it, and vitamin B6 can be helpful to support that pathway. And finally, we have our famous MTHFR, and that's the one that takes that last step we looked at earlier, 5-10 methylene THF into MTHFR. And you can see that it requires, it says riboflavin B2, but it also requires niacin as well with the NAD. And this is some other genes. I found an article. I'm going to give you the link to it. It said there were 118 different SNPs related to 14 specific genes. Some of these I listed twice because there's 2 variations on them. But these are the genes that this article found. So if you wanted to look in more detail about it, all of these are related to folate. So there's a few others that are on here that weren't on my original chart, and vice versa. This is a new and emerging science. Always something new. So who's impacted by MTHFR? Well, approximately 45% of the population has a copy of a particular SNP, the MTHFR C677T. So chances are that person in front of you, 1 in 2 chance that they have that gene, all right? And that gene mutation, we call them SNPs, single nucleotide polymorphism. It's basically a variation in one nucleotide. So when you see it listed as C677T, it means that there's a substitution from C to T or vice versa. And those are nucleotides. We'll get into that more when we do our nutrigenomics and methylation segment. But here's the deal. Approximately 45% of the general population has one copy of the gene, but approximately 90% of those with chronic disease have one copy of the gene. So that's a huge difference, isn't it? And Dr. Ben Lynch just recommends that everybody be tested, so at least you know. Because it's not just a matter of telling somebody who's ill just to take more folate just in case, you really want to make sure they're taking the right forms of it, and there's a whole bunch of other considerations. So just it's inexpensive enough to test these days. So let's look at synthetic versus folate. Folic acid does not equate to folate. So when you see it on a label, if you see folic acid, you suspect it's a synthetic. There are a few companies that put natural folates in, and they're just not up on the latest research, I think, in terms of knowing that people are banning the folic acid. So sometimes when you call, you just want to say, hey, I see you have folic acid. What's the form? And if they say, oh, it's pteromonoglutamate, you go, okay, that's synthetic. Or they say, oh, it's a 5-methyl tetrahydrofolate. You know that that's okay. All right. So folic acid is not found in nature. It's just synthesized. It must undergo various transformations prior to utilization. And here's where we show those three parts of it. And you can see with the methyl, there's the methyl group here, in addition to some of those other issues, shifts we showed you before. So there's lots of different types. There's folic acid, which is synthetic. There's folinic acid, 5-formyl tetrahydrofolate. And then there's 5-methyl, and there's a bunch more. This is a good video. I've given you the link to it. It's on Seeking Health. It's on YouTube, I think, and it's one done by Ben Lynch on the difference between folate and folic acid. So good one for you to watch. So in order for this pathway to work, you have to have enough folate. What do you need to have enough folate? Well, people think just take a folate supplement. No, the best way to get it is uncooked leafy greens, which is the best source. You need to have the functioning of the enzymes. You need to have receptors that are available that are not blocked. And when you eat synthetic folic acid, it blocks the receptors. You need to be able to transport. So remember the transport proteins that we talked about earlier. And you need these vitamins in addition to folate. You need B2, B6, B12. And you need an acidic environment for absorption. So a lot of things have to be right for someone to have good folate status. A lot of it goes back to our general recommendations for good, wholesome, healthy diet, but sometimes that's not enough, and you need to get in and start to play with these pathways. So you can see I marked on the pathways where these different vitamins come in. So before you address somebody's MTHFR, say, oh, they have an MTHFR, let me give them folate. Work on the foundational lifestyle and diet things. Remove all the folic acid. Have them go through their supplements. Have them go through their protein powders or whatever else they're taking. And their prescription prenatals. Get rid of the folic acid. Improve the B12 status, because when you don't improve the B12 status before you improve the folate status, you run the risk of methyl trapping. We talk about that more in the B12 a presentation. You also want to test the homocysteine levels to see, like, are their homocysteine levels actually high? If they are, it's likely because of this problem, but it also can be a further down problem with vitamin B6. So that's why addressing those other B vitamins is important as well. Of course, reducing their oxidative stress, reducing their processed foods, reducing their exposure to chemicals. Evaluating thyroid, and we'll look to see how the thyroid's related to this, and addressing mitochondrial dysfunction. Because remember, ATP is required for a lot of these interconversions. And if they've got impaired mitochondria, they're not going to be producing enough ATP to fund these pathways. And mitochondria can get damaged by toxic environments, by specific SNPs there, by deficiencies of nutrients, and by environmental overexposures. So those are all the things that need to be addressed before just saying, here, you've got an MTHFR, take folate. So let's look at the functions of folate. Number one, methylation. We talked about that. Number two, it supports the production and repair of DNA and RNA. Number three, erythropoiesis, meaning the creation of red blood cells. Number four, energy production. 5, removes homocysteine from the blood, and we'll see in a bit how damaging homocysteine can be. And it's important for protein metabolism. And folate works in synergy with B12 for maturation of red blood cells, helping iron work better in the body, and help to produce SAMe. Now, SAMe has a very calming effect on the nervous system. In addition to being the main methyl donor, it has an effect specifically on the mood. Let's take a look at folate and homocysteine. Homocysteine is a nerve and vessel toxin. It can damage the nerves and the blood vessels. Methionine is an essential amino acid. So some of the methionine that we eat is turned into homocysteine. But then the body normally converts homocysteine either back to methionine or down to in the sulfation pathway and eventually down into glutathione and cysteine and those sorts of things. Whenever that pathway is blocked, homocysteine increases. Folate is one of the causes of that pathway being blocked. It's not the only. B12 and B6 are very important as well. So homocysteine in heart disease is really a common correlation. And so when people have elevated homocysteine, they have a higher risk of heart disease. Homocysteine is thought to cause cardiovascular disease by causing oxidative stress and damage to the blood vessel walls. When the homocysteine is high, the risk of developing coronary artery disease actually doubles. And risk of stroke actually goes up by 2.5 times. So there's a risk factor. Increased risk factor for cardiovascular disease, stroke, coronary artery disease, heart attack, and also for blood clotting abnormalities and atherosclerosis before it gets to be a heart attack. And like we showed in the pictures, it's related to deficiencies of B6, B12, and folate. This is a picture again of the folate homocysteine pathway. Homocysteine is circled down here. If we have a deficiency in folate, or we have a deficiency of B12, or if we have a deficiency of B6, that homocysteine has nowhere to go, and it sits there, causing its damage. Folate is related to anemia, similar to the way that B12 is related to anemia. It causes what's called macrocytic anemia. And what you see there is that the mean corpuscular volume on a CBC, complete blood count, is elevated. The MCV is elevated. Megaloblastic anemia is like where you're looking. When you look under the microscope, you see large red blood cells. They call it megaloblastic anemia. If nobody's looked at the red blood cells to see if they're enlarged, they call it macrocytic anemia. Either way, it's an enlargement of the red blood cells because they're not maturing. Immature red blood cells are large. The folate, along with the B12, causes the maturation of those blood cells, and it causes them to shrink into the mature adult sizes. Kind of the opposite of kids turning into adults, eh? Let's take a quick look at folate in the thyroid. It's not as complicated. When you get an increase in homocysteine, remember down here, homocysteine, if this gets built up because you don't have enough B12 or folate to take it around, that can affect the thyroid receptors. It can actually damage thyroid receptors and can contribute to thyroid receptor resistance. And in these people, they're either people who have known thyroid problems, but they're not responding to their thyroid medication because nobody's addressing the thyroid receptor resistance. Or they're in people who don't know they have a thyroid problem because their blood tests all show up normal, but they kind of show signs of thyroid problems because their receptors aren't working well. So homocysteine is an important parameter to test for in the blood when you're working with somebody with thyroid. I would always test that homocysteine. T4 is needed to convert riboflavin to the active form of FAD, which is what's important in that MTHFR function, in that whole pathway that we looked at before. So very important. So folate is related to birth defects and neural tube defects. Back in 1998, it was discovered that there was a connection between folate and neural tube defects. So the Food and Drug Administration admonished all the food companies that they needed to add folic acid to things like pasta and flour and bread and all those refined products that they were selling. Indeed, it looks like the increased folate intakes has decreased the number of babies born with neural tube defects since 1998, but there are risks. So I think the takeaway here is that it's important to take the natural forms of folate rather than the synthetic, because the natural forms can prevent other things as well and be more effective. Now, if the mom has an MTHFR and she's taken the folate, she may not decrease the baby's risk because of those interactions. So since we don't know necessarily the person's genetics, I recommend that when someone's pregnant, that they take the folate in the suggested doses, like 800 micrograms a day, but that they take it in a methylated form or a more natural form. Okay, so there have been some studies that show decreased risk of having a premature baby or congenital heart problems. Cancer is a mixed bag with folate as well. It can decrease the risk of several forms of cancer. Before cancer develops, it can decrease the risk, but if high doses of folate are taken after, especially with colorectal cancer, there have been some indications that it might speed up the progression. So it's just really the takeaway is proceed with caution with doses in excess of 1,000 micrograms if there's a person with a history of cancer. There are a couple of indications, studies that say that people with a history of colorectal adenomas, which can sometimes turn into cancer, probably are at the highest risk of this happening. Probably not at risk if that's not the case, but you don't want to take a chance. I think the jury's out and a lot more research is needed. The brain and central nervous system and folate, there's a lot to be said here as well. It helps to support brain and nervous system function. A deficiency of folate can lead to imbalances in the neurotransmitters and can lead to things like depression and anxiety. So there are specific messaging molecules that are used by the nerves to send signals through the body. These are related to folate.
Folate is critical to brain and nervous system function due to its role in nucleic acid synthesis, which is related to DNA and repair, and its role in methylation reactions. High folate diets have been associated with decreased incidence of Alzheimer's disease. Now, there hasn't been a specific scientific study that said, you know, folic acid related to Alzheimer's, but there is that correlation. Adequate folate reduces the levels of homocysteine, which is known to impair cognitive function. Also, deficiencies of folate are related to depression because of folate's role in methylation, which is related to the synthesis of the neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin. Folate's also related to something called the BH4 cycle, the tetrahydrobiopterin cycle. So the BH4 is actually required for monoamine neurotransmitter synthesis. And those monoamine neurotransmitters are known as dopamine and serotonin are among those. So folate stabilizes the production of BH4, which is required for synthesis of these. BH4 is also required for the conversion of phenylalanine to tyrosine. Tyrosine is a precursor to dopamine, which is a very important neurotransmitter. BH4 crosses the blood-brain barrier using the same transport mechanism as folate, so they're interacting there as well. There's also some possible connections between levels of GABA and glutamic acid in the brain because of the structure of the folate molecule. Remember that there's that glutamine or glutamate, that's any number of them, the polyglutamic part of the folate molecule. So that's a summary of some of the ways that folate is related to the brain and the nervous system function.
There are certain drugs that will interfere with folate metabolism. Most notable is methotrexate. Some of the brand names are Rumitrex and Trexol. Anti-epileptic medications as well, such as phenytoin or Dilantin, Carbitrol, Tegretol, Equatrol, Equipol, Valproate, all of these can be related. So all the anti-epileptic medicines can reduce the folate availability, and we may want to look at making sure that that person's getting enough folate. And then sulfalazine for ulcerative colitis. So all of these medications can be related. What nutrients does folate interact with? Well, it interacts with B6. We saw that B6 was required for one of those pathways, those reductases. And then riboflavin, again, related to one of the pathways as well. So it's very important that we have enough riboflavin, vitamin B2, and vitamin B6 in order to have good folate functioning. This is just a chart of all the different levels of folate that are recommended for different stages in a childhood and adult. Okay, so breastfeeding and teen women are recommended up in the 500 micrograms, pregnant women 600 micrograms. There are a lot of food sources. Most of the vegetables, the green leafy vegetables, spinach, mustard greens, Brussels sprouts, and asparagus. Avocado is a good source of folate. Some fruits, especially oranges, papaya, grapefruit, and strawberries, but again, going back to that whole irony of foods that are highest, we found that the oranges tend to interfere with the transport, the uptake and transport. So it's all like everything in moderation. Some of the nuts and seeds, like almonds, flax, and sunflower seeds. Legumes like lentils, kidney beans, and black-eyed peas, although we said that lentils had one of those, it was one of the interfering factors. And then there's a little bit in animal products, most notably in beef liver. Why? Because, well, the liver stores the folate, but most of it is found in your green leafies. So the forms that we find in food are the methylfolates, the dihydrofolates, the monoglutamyl folates, the polyglutamyl folates. Fortified enriched food contains just folic acid. This was taken from WH Foods. This is a chart. You can go there to see the full chart. I've given you the link. And you could just Google WH Foods and folate. They have some good statistics and good sources and good amounts. So we look at lentils that are at the top of the list. They have 338 micrograms of folate. And if we're looking at as an adult that's not pregnant, taking about 400, you could see that you just need one cup of lentils to do it. Asparagus, very good. One cup of asparagus is in the 200. Spinach is very good. Turnip greens, broccoli, beets, and all of these are 1 to 2 cup servings. If you're like me, you eat a huge salad that has like 4 or 5 of these cups. So you can see that, and it's sorted by the amount of folate in there. And you can go check that out. There are some herbs that have been reported to be high in folate. Things like nettle leaf, red clover, oat straw, parsley and basil. Parsley and basil are easy to get in your diet, parsley and basil, and also some of those others that are made into teas and taken therapeutically. Let's see, let's talk about the bioavailability of folate. So we get all this folate in the foods, but how much are we going to actually absorb? 60 to 98%, we said before, probably an average of 50%, depending on how much it's been transported, how much is it lost, how much has it been heated. The good news is the methylated, the 5-methyltetrahydrofolate, is the major form in most plants. So you can bypass problems with that genetic piece by eating an abundance of plant foods. The 5-MTHF appears to be the only form that crosses the blood-brain barrier. Maybe a little bit of the others get in. And the daily allowances don't really tell the whole story with respect to health benefits. Everybody's a little different, and you've got to treat them that way. Really, bottom line is whole, fresh, natural foods with a variety of forms is the best. So what do we see in folate deficiency? We see megaloblastic anemia, which is comprised of weakness, fatigue, difficulty concentrating, irritability, headache, heart palpitations, shortness of breath. We sometimes see open sores on the tongue and inside of the mouth. Changes in the color of the skin, hair, or fingernails. Restless leg syndrome, neural tube defects like spina bifida, and premature or low birth weight babies. So what are some of the risk factors for folate deficiency? Well, pregnant, because the need goes up. Intestinal problems that interfere with absorption, like celiac or Crohn's disease in active states. Alcohol, which interrupts the absorption. Certain prescription medications. We talked about some of those earlier. Anti-seizure medications. We talked about those. They block the absorption. If somebody's on hemodialysis for kidney failure, they're likely at risk of folate deficiency. And of course, people that don't eat enough fresh vegetables or consistently overcook their vegetables, they're going to be at risk for folate deficiency. What are the populations that are most at risk? Teen girls, because they need more and they eat more sporadically than adults. Women in the ages of 18 to 30 tend to have a higher need, especially before and during pregnancy. Interesting that non-Hispanic Black women tend to have a higher risk of deficiency. People with celiac disease, people with inflammatory bowel, and alcoholics. So all those folks are at risk. So let's look at folate excess. Can we get excess folate? What happens if we do? So if you take or you have a client take large doses of folate and they're not taking B12, it can mask it and lead to nerve damage. So large doses are considered more than 800 micrograms. And this is super important to know when you're taking a history on someone and finding out what vitamins they're taking. Or if they're eating a lot of leafy greens and they're taking a supplement and they're not taking B12 along the way, you've got to be aware that that can be causing a problem because it'll mask the anemia problem and it will cause nerve damage. High doses of folic acid can also increase the risk of colorectal cancer and other cancers in some people. So, like I said, jury's out on that one. I think a lot more research needs to be done, but just go carefully with someone when you're putting them on higher doses, especially if they have a history of colorectal cancer. So these are some of the RDAs. They go from 1,000 micrograms for the adult. And this, again, it's not the RDA, but it's just like the maximum dose that's recommended is about 1,000 for adults. How do we know if there's enough folate? Well, you can look at their dietary history and see. That's not going to tell you how well they're absorbing or transporting, but it's going to tell you how much they're getting in. You can look at serum or plasma. And remember, we looked at that before and we said that that just reflects the recent. So if they take a bunch of folate and then they go test their blood the next day, you're going to see that in the blood as normal. And that's what I think might happen with a lot of folks. If you want to look at it long-term over a 2 or 3 month period, you're going to have to look at the red blood cell folate. Homocysteine, that's a good indicator. You've got to look and make sure that B12 is adequate because the homocysteine might not indicate a folate deficiency. It might indicate a B12 deficiency. And then there's something called hypersegmentation of the neutrophils where they can look at the cells and see if they're hypersegmented, meaning they didn't get to mature. And then, of course, the CBC on the blood panel, looking for increased MCV, which is the size of the red blood cells. When you're looking to supplement your client with folate, there's a lot of different choices, and it can be really confusing, and it's hard to know what the best form is. You have to know the lingo. You have to know what you're looking for. So the best forms are L5-MTHF. So anything with the L5-MTHF, or it'll list it as L5-methyltetrahydrofolate, same thing. Also, same thing is 6, and in parentheses, S-LMTF, or methyltetrahydrofolate. So if you see those on there, those are actually the better forms, the best forms, because they're the most biologically active. In nature, in the way that these molecules go, there's the chemical structure, like what the atoms are, and then there's the shape of it three-dimensionally. So the L form and the D form are actually a different shape. It's just, you know, twisted in three-dimensional space a little bit different. And that can change the function dramatically. So the most active form is actually the L. So you want to really read it. A lot of them will say MTHF. If it doesn't say whether it's L or D or mixed, then you need to contact the manufacturer to make sure. Some of the ones that I use, like Seeking Health and Thorne, they'll specifically say L5. They also may say quadrifolate, and that's also the same sort of thing. So those are the best absorbed. Another kind of well-absorbed is what there's actually prescription medication called metafolin and levometafolic acid. That form is actually the L-methylfolate with calcium, so bonded to calcium. So those are well absorbed as well. They're a little harder to get. You're mostly going to see the L5s. But you do have to be careful if it just says 5-MTHF or 5-tetrahydrofolate or 5-methylfolate.
because they may not be pure. Like 99% pure is what you're going to get with the L form. If it says L, it's going to be 99% the L form. But you don't know whether it's D or L or what percentage it is if it just says 5-MTHF. So just a word of caution to look for those. Those are all the same. So each of the three or four that are in these groups are actually pretty much the same. They're equivalent. So look for that and just proceed with caution. If you really like a brand or your client has that particular brand, just check in with the manufacturer. Because what happens is if you get something and instead of it being the L form, it's mostly the D form, then you're not going to be getting the same effect. So if you think you're giving them like 1,000 micrograms and it's the D form, maybe only 200 micrograms is going to be usable. So you really have to be careful. The ones you want to avoid are the ones that actually say D, D5, MTHF, D5, methyl tetrahydrofolate, 6R-L, methyl. So see the 6R versus S, okay? So there's a subtle difference, but it's a huge difference in the functioning. So the D and the L forms are actually what's called stereoisomers. And there's a particular type of stereoisomer, the diastereoisomer. And those in particular may not have the same function at all. So it changes the shape, and it significantly can change the function. So be careful of these, the D and the L forms. Yeah, so just when you're supplementing, if you're recommending a particular brand, make sure that you're recommending the right brands. If your client is already using something, make sure you either have them check or you check with that brand, and you'll know that. And I would just keep a list. If you're finding some that are good and some that aren't, based on what your clients are coming in and showing you, then just keep yourself a little cheat sheet so the next client comes along, you can advise them about what you found. Right. How do we take folate? Okay, we can actually take a topical cream. There's a company, I think it's called Neurogistics, that has a topical cream that's both B12 and folate. They call it methylation support. You can get it liposomal. That's how I usually recommend it. You could do sublingual drops, sublingual lozenges, capsules, tablets, soft gels, lozenges. You're going to see a slightly different effectiveness in each type of administration. All right, that's it. I have some references for you. These are some of the books. I really like these books. You can take a look through any of them you want to. You can just browse. And here's some videos that I found. And these are very good. Excellent, actually. So thanks for listening in. I think it was really a lot of valuable information that you can take and use with your clients right away. So thanks for being here, and we'll see you on the next nutrient.